judge's order says, if there's something that's disclosable, do it. And if it's not disclosable, provide a privilege log like the law requires.
Media organizations win in court to receive documents from the state related to the National Guard. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 30th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a new pre-maternal home opens in Bethel with some important improvements.
The first and foremost thing everybody notices is there's more bathrooms.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Crowley, fueling Alaska for more than 60 years with a full range of residential, commercial, aviation, and marine fuel products. Crowley also fuels community events, from summer fun runs to public radio. More at CrowleyFuels.com.
An Alaska Superior Court judge ruled today that the governor's office must start providing documents about the National Guard scandal to Alaska Public Media and Alaska Dispatch News. The state has until noon tomorrow to hand over any related public records they have already identified and a privilege log that explains why they cannot provide other documents. Judge Gregory Miller said that the state had violated its own regulations and statutes by waiting until September to rely on the records requests submitted in May and June. When the state did finally reply, they did not provide either documents or a privilege log. Attorney John McKay argued the case on behalf of the news organizations. He says the judge acted reasonably by requiring the release of documents.
The judge's order says if there's something that's disclosable, do it. And if it's not disclosable, provide a privilege log like the law requires, neither of which they've been doing, and both of which they agreed to do.
The news organization sued the state in the beginning of October and soon after came to an agreement with the Department of Law. The state said they would start producing the documents as soon as possible and provide them on a rolling basis. They did not. Assistant Attorney General Libby Bacalar argued this case on behalf of the state. She said that the delay was due to the privilege of the executive branch to review all of the documents and see if releasing them would violate anyone's rights. Bacalar denied an interview request after the hearing. The governor's office was given 717 pages of documents cleared by the Department of Law on October 21st. The state could try to appeal the decision and ask for a stay from the state Supreme Court. As Election Day nears, Native organizations in Juneau are making one last big push to encourage voters through a Get Out the Native Vote information rally on Saturday. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
The rally will feature a simulated voting booth for first-time voters, information on candidates and ballot measures, and entertainment. The event is being organized by Tlingit Haida Central Council, Huna Totem Corporation, Tlingit Haida Regional Housing Authority, Ha'ani, and University of Alaska Southeast. This is the first election season Native groups in Southeast Alaska have officially come together to try and boost the Native vote. Sean Blumenshine is with Ha'ani, a subsidiary of Sea Alaska, the regional Native corporation for Southeast.
The biggest thing that we're trying to focus is to express our voice, to have a Native voice, to participate in this process, and then voting informed. You know, not just voting, but also know what you're voting for, know the candidates.
In past years, Native entities worked independently to increase voter turnout. In 2010, Blumenshine says Sea Alaska organized a voter challenge in Heidelberg, a community of about 400 on Prince of Wales Island.
We did a yard sign project where on one side it says, I'm Native, I vote. On the other side it says, I voted, have you? So the idea was that you could go around and put the signs in the yards, and once you voted, you could turn around. And then your neighbors get an idea of how many people are voting, and it encourages other people to vote.
That year, 21 people in Heidelberg voted in the primary election. Blumenshine says the yard sign project helped bring out more than 100 people in the general election. This year's collaboration was spurred by the statewide Get Out the Native Vote effort of ANCSA Regional Association, a group of Native corporation CEOs. Nancy Barnes works for Huna Totem, the village corporation for the city of Huna. She says coming together to work toward the same goal makes sense.
People before us, you know, my parents and grandparents fought hard to get the right for us to even vote. We just want our people, and when I say our people, Alaska Natives, to get out to vote.
Barnes says the Get Out the Native Vote effort can be seen all over the state. The Alaska Federation of Natives handed out a 28-page voting guide highlighting the U.S. Senate and governor races at its recent convention in Anchorage.
We actually had people voting across the street. We carried signs and had people following us over to vote early. It was awesome.
Barnes says every vote counts, especially in rural Alaska. She brings up Huna's recent runoff election for mayor, where Kenneth Skaffelstad defeated Jacqueline Dick by only 2 votes. Juneau's Get Out the Native Vote group held a voter registration event in September, attended by a couple hundred people. Barnes says she registered a homeless woman who had never voted before.
I'm telling people, grab 5 friends or relatives and get them to vote, or call them and urge them to vote.
On Election Day, Get Out the Native Vote in Juneau plans to offer rides to the polls. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
A facility that has lowered infant and mother morbidity rates in the YK Delta has a new home. Bethel's pre-maternal home has moved to a new building along the Chief Eddie Hoffman Highway. The new home is 3 times the size of the old one and has improved amenities for the region's expectant mothers during the final stage of pregnancy. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
With her flowing black hair and a light blue dress that shows off her full pregnant belly, the woman in the window art at the front door of Bethel's new pre-maternal home could be any of the hundreds who stay at the facility while they await the birth of their babies.
These are not stained glass, but there's 3 of them in the windows, and they're an acrylic paint. So she's pretty prominent here, and she's pretty special.
She's even painted onto the barriers in the parking lot. That's Doreen O'Brien. She's managed the pre-maternal home for 24 years. The home is run by the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. It houses pregnant women from the surrounding 58 villages that YKHC serves during the last month of their pregnancy, so that they can more easily access care required and are closer to emergency services should there be a complication. The new home is a huge improvement over the old one, says O'Brien.
The first and foremost thing everybody notices is there's more bathrooms. Down there we had 24 beds and all our staff, and there was 3 bathrooms.
The rooms where women stay are larger, and they have nearly double the number of beds of the old home, 45. There's a movie and game room, a commercial kitchen, a laundry room, and even a workout room. The home is spacious.
This place is 17,000 square feet with 15 bedrooms, 8 bathrooms. In their rooms, we have 2 public restrooms as well. And just the size, the old building was 5,000 square feet. This is 17,000 square feet. So it's 3 times the size that we were in.
The home started out as a standalone nonprofit in the late 60s, after local healthcare workers realized that many Native women from surrounding villages who'd been directed by healthcare providers to relocate to Bethel had nowhere to go. Some were living in poor conditions, even outside.
In 1967, there was a lady found living under an overturned boat up by the old Indian Health Service Hospital, about where the new YK building is now. And when the medical staff, somebody went out and found her out there and said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Well, they told me to come to Bethel to have my baby and be safe, but I don't have any place to stay." So that woke people up and realized that the women were coming in from the surrounding 58 villages, but where were they staying?
An ad hoc committee got together and the Hoffman family donated a house. By 1971, the home had relocated to what is now the old pre-maternal home, a little pink building near the Lutheran Church. YKHC took over in 2004. O'Brien says the old maternal home wasn't ideal.
There was at one time I had 37 women at that pre-maternal home. We had a big storm come in January, and every time a plane went to a village, they'd throw the pregnant women on it and bring them to town, and they'd be standing at the door, and I says, "Well, I can't just put you out in the street," and there was no place else for them. We had ladies sleeping on the couches, and I went to town in Bethel and bought every rollaway bed that was Known to Man in Bethel, and we put them up.
Today, each woman gets her own bed and a spacious dorm room with a shared bathroom. Back at the front entry, O'Brien gazes up at the design of the pregnant woman on the glass between the entry and the dining area and marvels at just how far the Home for Expectant Mothers has come.
The first design of the new prematernal home back in 96 or something, and that was on the proposal booklet that was going out for grants. So there she is. She's just kind of there, waiting.
And now she, along with the hundreds of women who spend their final weeks of pregnancy at the home, will have a much nicer place to bide their time until baby arrives. Construction of the new prematernal home was paid for through a state capital appropriation of $12.6 million. The official grand opening is set for Tuesday, November 18th. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, wildlife managers are trying to prevent caribou from populating new islands in the Aleutian.
Caribou are well known to be swimmers, and I guess once in a while they decide to take the plunge and look for a new habitat, new place to call home.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by the Historic Anchorage Hotel, a mix of historical architecture and modern technology, offers banquet facilities with catering and bartenders, a boutique hotel in the heart of downtown, historicanchoragehotel.com.
While the governor's office is now being told to provide more National Guard records or explain the reasons for withholding them, the administration did hand over a 352-page log of records that could be relevant earlier this week. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that hints of a timeline emerge in the document that outlines the Parnell administration's response to the allegations.
The log begins from the day that Governor Sean Parnell took office in 2009 and was produced using search terms like National Guard, misconduct, fraud, and assault. Many of the 12,000 emails do not seem relevant to the request and cover things like Arctic policy meetings and disaster response. But about 60 pages in, the name of a whistleblower shows up in the subject line of an email between the governor and his scheduler in November of 2010. From that point on, Alaska National Guard Chaplain Matt Freese sent 30 separate emails to the governor's office through the end of 2011. While Freese could not be reached, his colleague Rick Cavins says those correspondences began after Chaplain's teleconference with the governor 4 years ago and that they were a group effort.
We then started conversations through Mike Nysick, who worked for the governor, and we were to go through him and not go through the governor.
Caven says many of the complaints specifically concerned National Guard leadership. Nothing in the log indicates that those records were directly forwarded from Nysick's account to Parnell. The governor's office declined to comment on the log and did not clarify if the governor was provided physical copies of emails or briefed on them. But Parnell has previously said he was informed of every complaint. Caven says one of the specific requirements the chaplains had in dealing with the governor's office is that their communication not be shared with then-Adjutant General Thomas Katkus, who was asked to resign in September. Caven says they were afraid of reprisal.
We didn't want leadership involved. We had tried to talk to leadership. It hadn't gone anywhere.
At the end of 2011, communications between the chaplains and Chief of Staff Mike Nysick suddenly broke down. On December 22nd of that year, Caven sent an email with the subject line compromised. He shared a copy with APRN, and in it, he accused Nysick of violating confidentiality. Cavins wrote that Adjutant General Katkus told one of the chaplains that he was aware that a group of them, quote, have been a conduit to the governor. Cavins believed Nysick had identified them to guard leadership. He wrote, quote, "You understood that confidentiality for chaplains is dear, and that we have all tried our chain of command and why Chaplain Freese contacted you in frustration. At this point in time, I do not see you as a trusted agent for positive change and growth in the Alaska National Guard," end quote.
The only way they would know that it was that individual and us is because we had given that information to Nysick. Nysick, in a rebuttal email, became quite agitated, but clearly, and I wrote that email, I wasn't going to communicate with the man anymore. I did not trust him. And if he was giving information to the governor, it was compromised information.
Nysick strongly denied breaching confidentiality in his response, saying he was disappointed and extremely frustrated by Cavan's suggestion. Nysick, who declined an interview via the governor's spokesperson, also emphasized that progress had been made within the Guard that year, and that was because of the work of the governor's office. Cavan's disputes that.
No, it actually got worse. There was more leadership that was installed that had a tendency to bully. We were distanced, or I felt I was. I didn't see any positive changes, and I really don't believe that there were any really instigated.
After the emails from the chaplain stopped at the end of 2011, there was a lull in obviously relevant communication about the Guard's problems to the governor's office. But at the end of 2012, subject lines that directly relate to complaints about the National Guard begin popping up again. They are forwarded emails by Nancy Dahlstrom, who was then a special assistant with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. She passed on nearly a dozen complaints between December 2012 and February 2013. One email specifically mentions National Guard whistleblower Ken Blaylock in the subject line. Some are colorfully titled, like Another Example of Theft, Ghost Employees, and Imprecatory Prayers and That Racist Holiday. One forward is just labeled Kodiak Entertainment Group, a pornography company owned by one of the leaders of the Guard's recruitment unit.
There were allegations of different types of sexual assault, fraud, theft, drug running, gun smuggling, really serious things like that.
Dahlstrom says that when she first reached out to Nysick about complaints concerning the Guard and its leadership, she was directed to involve Adjutant General Kakis and told that the administration had already addressed these types of allegations.
When I first brought these emails to the attention of the Chief of Staff, I was told that some similar things had come up before and that they had been checked out and there was nothing to them. But when the different allegations kept coming to me, I, you know, kept on sending them up the chain, and I was not privy to any information on who had investigated or what. I was just told that it had been done.
Dahlstrom says that one of the people who regularly emailed her was perceived as a disgruntled employee. Dahlstrom says even so, she continued to pass on complaints and at one point delivered a package related to the National Guard to the Federal Bureau of Investigations. She says that while she can only speak for herself, she took the complaint seriously.
I knew that it needed to be dealt with one way or another. If it was true, something needed to be done. And if it wasn't true, something needed to be done.
Once Dahlstrom left her position with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, there was again a drop-off in clear communication about misconduct in the National Guard. Obvious emails only pick up at the end of 2013, when the Anchorage Daily News first published a story about problems with the Guard that October. Communication within the governor's office about misconduct within the Guard appears active from that time on, with subject lines referring to news stories, records requests, and involvement of the National Guard Bureau. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes, or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Tonga's national forest officials want the timber industry to log and process fewer old trees. They're planning a 10 to 15-year transition to harvesting younger forests. Two Oregon researchers, one an industry consultant and the other an environmental activist, say it can happen sooner. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld talked to them about their plan, one of several under discussion.
Loggers working the Tongass National Forest harvested large numbers of older trees from the 1950s through much of the 1990s. Harvests have since slowed and in recent years almost stopped. Tongass officials and environmental groups say the future is in young or second growth, mostly trees that have grown back after earlier decades' clear cuts. But that's a challenging goal.
Transitioning out of old growth and into young growth, you cannot just flip a switch and do it.
Catherine Mader is president of Mader Limited, where she consults for timber companies on industry issues. She's based in Corvallis, Oregon, but has worked in Southeast for Viking Lumber and the Sea Alaska Corporation.
I don't think it's realistic to assume that all old growth logging is going to go away, but I do feel very optimistic that there's an opportunity to have a transition and replacement from majority of old growth now to majority of young growth.
Mader's partnered with Dominic Della Sala of the Ashland, Oregon-based Geos Institute, which researches climate change and related environmental issues. Together, they're promoting a study detailing how the Tongass National Forest can quickly change from old growth to younger growth harvests. Della Sala says they began by looking at the most controversial forest stands, the ones that lead to appeals and lawsuits.
So we took those off the table, and then we wanted to see what was left where we could come up with some higher levels of certainty, where the wood can get to the mills quicker without litigation, without appeals, and without the expenses that go into that.
They also eliminated areas too far away from roads or otherwise economically unfeasible. Mader says that leaves enough land to start a sustainable young growth timber industry. That includes forests that could produce 25 to 30 million board feet of timber very soon.
We have pre-commercially thinned lands in the National Forest System that offer us a unique opportunity to do that.
She and Della Sala say the young growth industry could start now and be fully functional in about 5 years. That's less than the 10 to 15-year period projected by the Forest Service. Another difference, they say 55-year-old trees can be harvested, while the agency usually considers 90 as the minimum marketable age. Mader says the new industry would be different from what we have today. She says it would move from construction or dimensional lumber to smaller, more heavily processed products.
This is the stuff that goes into your windows and doors that you see in your homes and in your buildings, in panel-grade material and in custom-grade material. Nobody has evaluated Southeast Alaska's second growth material in those particular grade factors.
She says that research could be done in about a year and a half. Mader says new mills would likely be needed to process the younger trees, but she says some old growth harvests would continue to keep existing mills going. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Adak Island is home to something you won't find elsewhere in the Aleutians, a herd of caribou introduced in the 1950s as a hunting option for the old naval base there. The base is closed, but the caribou are still thriving, and lately some have been striking out for newer pastures. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, it's got wildlife refuge managers looking to keep a herd from forming where hunters can't follow.
Kegalaska Island makes pretty appealing habitat for an enterprising caribou. It's uninhabited, roomy, and full of tasty lichen beds, and it's just a short swim away from Adak. Both islands are part of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, where Steve Delahanty is manager. Of the 2,000 or so caribou on Adak, he says a handful have been spotted on Kegalaska in the past 2 years.
I'm not a caribou. I don't know just what's going through their mind, but if you're standing on Adak, you can look across on a semi-clear day, and you can see land there, and caribou are well known to be swimmers, and I guess once in a while they decide to take the plunge and look for new habitat, new place to call home.
Cape Alaska is only about half a mile from Adak at its closest point, but Delahanty says the rough water between the two islands makes it impractical to even try to hunt there. And since the Aleutians aren't home to any of mainland Alaska's other big mammals, like wolves, the caribou could flourish in their new environment.
It's pretty common to have kind of a population boom in an island setting when an animal is brought that doesn't have any natural predators. The population will grow and grow and grow, and sometimes they'll sort of eat themselves out of house and home, and the population will crash.
Delahanty says it's his job to preserve the natural order of the refuge, and the non-native caribou don't belong. So the refuge is proposing sending staff to Cape Alaska about once a year to walk around and shoot any caribou they find. After that, Delahanty says they'd follow government policy and decide case by case whether it was worth it to salvage and donate a dead animal to subsistence users back on Adak.
I think everybody prefers that if it's possible, but there also comes a balance of, you know, reasonableness and cost effectiveness. You have to realize how remote this site is and how logistically challenging it is. And again, there are a couple thousand of them on Adak.
He stressed that the control plan wouldn't interfere at all with that well-established herd, which is a food source for Adak and a big tourism draw. On Cape Alaska, though, Delahanty says the caribou aren't just introduced, they're invasive.
Even though they're swimming by themselves to get to Cape Alaska Island, they never would have gotten there except for the fact that humans brought them to Adak. So it's a kind of a human-originating problem.
But he's not sure yet how their human-powered solution will work. Staff could do the caribou control during their annual Aleutian tour on their research ship Tekla. It'd be convenient since Adak's hard to get to otherwise, and it's already in the refuge budget. An annual visit to Cape Alaska might not be enough, though. Refuge staff set foot on the island so rarely right now that they don't have good data on how many caribou are moving there or how often. That's something else they'd look to find when they went scouting for new herds. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
And by
Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. Didn't quite catch that report. Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.